You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. Connor is taking us to Brazil now.
Indeed. We're going to talk about the Brazilian election, which I've heard, I'm sure you've heard a lot about. There's a far-right candidate who's just won the first round of the election with 46% of the vote, which is not enough to fill a majority. The second guy is trailing by 28%. What I'm going to do, that's all going to come in the thing. What I'm going to do is I'm going to focus on, there's three main issues in this election. There's crime, unemployment, and corruption. There's one issue that kind of unites the three, is at the heart of Brazilian society, and that is discussing, so we're going to get to that, and that's discussing race and class in Brazil and how Brazilian society is made up, so that you understand the voters, you understand why they're voting, and the historical stuff that has gone on to understand why they've gone for far right candidates. I guess what I'm going to try and do is just give you kind of quick explanation on it, but I will give a bit of a disclaimer. First thing is, there is a mention of sexual assault within this piece, so do, if you are affected by that at all, or if it's something that would potentially trigger, then I would advise tuning out. Equally as well, I'm going over about 500 years worth of history and the election and a whole load of socio-economic stuff in about 12 minutes. If I'm touching on stuff and then moving on very quickly, that's not because it's not important. That's because I'm trying to get through a lot of content in a very short space of time. So if I seem like this happened and then this happened and then this happened, that's not me delegitimizing the importance of what happened. That's just me trying to cover it and give it mention as much as possible within these 12, 13 minutes.
Let's get into it.
Yeah.
This is Jair Bolsonaro. He's been called the Donald Trump of Brazil. He's one of the country's most controversial political figures, and he's rising in the polls for the 2018 elections.
You're going to face an army captain, an extremely strong presidential candidate in 2018. You can be sure of that.
Under the dictatorship, he served as a captain in the Brazilian military. And he's been a congressional representative for the state of Rio de Janeiro since the early 1990s. But mostly, he's been known for his bombastic, homophobic, xenophobic, racist, and sexist rhetoric. Sound familiar? The Intercept published an article about him in 2014 titled, "The Most Misogynistic, Hateful Elected Official in the Democratic World." It highlighted a laundry list of his most egregious remarks, including telling a fellow lawmaker that she didn't deserve to be raped, and that he would rather have his own son die in a car accident than be gay. He's been fined for his comments. He's defended the dictatorship, applauded the killing of landless workers, and carries a gun. He's promised to fight violence with violence, and his support is growing amid the country's worst financial recession ever and a massive ongoing corruption investigation that has already taken down dozens of top political figures.
Brazil is currently having one of the most important elections in its history. If one looks at the Brazilian flag, the motto in the middle of the blue globe reads, Ordem e Progresso, or Order and Progress. This election proves that those three words have vastly different meanings in modern Brazil, to either side of the political spectrum. This year's election comes among one of the worst episodes of political turmoil in the country's history, and it seems that amidst the chaos, instability, and distrust between people and representatives, Jair Bolsonaro and his far-right Social Liberal Party, or PSL, are coming out on top with 46% of the vote in the first round. But this was not enough to secure a majority to form a government, and on the 28th of October he will go into the second round in a head-to-head battle with Workers' Party candidate Fernando Haddad, who is facing an uphill battle to regain trust of the Brazilian people for his party after former party leader Lula was imprisoned for corruption.
Fernando Haddad is only here running for president because former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva couldn't be. The former mayor of São Paulo only became the Workers' Party candidate after the electoral court barred Lula from running. His opponents say he's just a stand-in and that Lula da Silva would effectively run the country from jail, where he's serving a 12-year sentence on corruption charges. His first high-profile position was as education minister in Lula da Silva's government in 2005. He would go on to win his first run for office in 2012 as mayor of São Paulo. But 4 years later, he lost his re-election bid.
Fernando Haddad's conciliatory style and modern image were key elements in the choice of his name to run for the Workers' Party.
And he also has a big advantage in not having been touched by the corruption probes that hit his party and put many of its officials in jail, including former President Lula da Silva.
If Haddad does reach the second round, a big question is whether his clean past would be enough to overcome the disappointment and disdain felt by much of Brazil's society towards the Workers' Party, known as PT.
In Brazil today, we have a clear-cut division in the society. A sector that hates PT, and I think that this is a problem, is a kind of an irrational hate against the PT, and it's very divisive, and so some people think that they won't vote for the PT. It doesn't matter why, it doesn't matter what can happen. It will be very difficult for him if he doesn't establish this bridge between the PT and between the other parties of the center.
The political situation in Brazil is very representative of its political history and social makeup. Like its former colonial ruler Portugal, Brazil does not have a long tradition of democratic freedom or the rule of law. Its history has largely been marked by authoritarian regimes, be they outright authoritarian or just flawed democratic regimes. Democracy only came to Brazil in the 1980s, and only because Brazilians who once benefited from authoritarianism started to lose trust in the military regime's ability to maintain the consistent growth of the economy. Essentially, as Spain, Portugal, South Korea, and Taiwan were all making the transition from right-wing nationalist authoritarianism to free liberal democracy, Brazil's military saw the writing on the wall and headed in a similar direction. But unlike Portugal or Spain, where members of the authoritarian establishment were ousted from power in non-violent civilian-led coups, the establishment largely remained the same in Brazil, guiding liberal reforms from the seat of power. Yet today, amidst corruption, economic stagnation, and rising unemployment, many Brazilian voters are starting to look nostalgically back to the 60s and 70s as a time of stability, progress, and dignity for Brazil, irrespective of the widespread torture, press intimidation, poverty, and institutionalized racism that was encouraged under the military junta. In short, Brazil appears to be sliding back into its old habits. But who are the Brazilians voting to make Brazil great again? Well, to explain this, we need to talk about race and class. Brazil has its own unique relationship with these concepts. Socioeconomic divides perpetuate society on a scale more extreme than the US. In fact, they're probably more comparable to South Africa. But the definitions of what constitutes white and what constitutes black are not definitions we might recognize in the English-speaking world. We'll start with the white Brazilians and who they are. This is important because their story is key to Brazil's political values, considering they have largely held the political power. Portugal colonized Brazil in 1500 and created 15 colonies along the coast, and Brazil, as we know it today, came into being. They took the land, tried to enslave the indigenous people who didn't die from the introduced diseases, but gave up on enslaving the indigenous Brazilians after they realized they were outnumbered, when expeditions to capture slaves were always followed by large-scale attacks and killings at Portuguese settlements. So when sugar was found, they brought African slaves over instead. Essentially, the British ripped off the idea of America from the Portuguese in Brazil. White Portuguese and others came in droves with promises of land as Brazil expanded right into the Amazon, taking more and more land. The key moment in Brazilian history, though, was in 1821. The Portuguese royal family saw Napoleon of France expanding and saw the writing on the wall, fleeing to Brazil. To maintain power, they turned Brazil from a colony into an integral part of Portugal. The problem was when Lord Nelson won the Battle of Waterloo and exiled Napoleon, and Portugal decided around the same time that they didn't want absolute monarchy anymore, so they forced the king back to Portugal to sign a new constitution. Brazil was on board with the new constitution except for one thing. Brazil would have been downgraded to a colony again and would have lost any say over their own affairs, including trade. Brazil liked their newfound independence and had the king's son, Pedro, on board with their cause. So Brazil seized the moment, declared independence, Pedro became emperor of Brazil, and the Empire of Brazil became incredibly wealthy. They took more land, invited even more white people over from Europe, and imported more slaves than any other nation on earth. But the aristocracy still ruled. They did not believe in the Chartist ideas the UK, France, Holland, the US, or Australia had implemented at that point. the idea that any man, irrespective of means or status, could exercise political power. Hence why white Brazilians to this day still believe that they have a right to the power over Brazil. Almost an ingrained sense of status that goes back to Brazilian and Portuguese quasi-constitutional monarchy. And the idea that they were chosen and that they are the only ones fit to decide over the affairs of the country, either because they're rich or through their bloodline. As for black Brazilians, here's a little background to the infamous favelas that define the poorest of Brazil.
If you go to a Google map of Rio de Janeiro and put it into 3D mode, you can see what the city looks like as it was designed by urban planners. But you'll notice parts of the city that don't look like the rest. The people who live in these parts of the city with the clean lines and the well-thought-out design are called people of the asphalt. The people who live in these parts of the city are called people of the hill. Even though the people of the asphalt and the people of the hill live closely intertwined throughout the city, they live vastly different lives. These informal communities that look like houses stacked on top of each other, sprouting out of the jungle, are called favelas, home to both vicious drug gangs as well as some of the most peaceful, creative, and resourceful people in Rio. A favela is a community that was built without any oversight of a public authority. No zoning, no building codes, no public services. These places just kind of grew out of the hills over time thanks to two main factors. First was slavery. Brazil imported 11 times more slaves than the United States did, and Rio alone was home to more slaves than the entire American South. Slavery ended in 1888, and free slaves, still denied many rights in society, built these informal communities on their own.
On top of this, because the Protestant Victorian values of indigenous equals savage and satanic, and European equals godly and righteous, weren't really a thing in Catholic Brazil like they were in the US, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, miscegenation was very common. However, not in the progressive way that we know interracial relations today. Slave owners regularly sexually abused their slaves, and escaped slaves regularly had relations with indigenous Brazilians. Hence why this is generally Brazil's view on race in a country as mixed and diverse as it is.
Something very important to keep in mind is there's no one-drop rule in Brazil like there is here in the US where I live. So interpretations on identity are in the eye of the beholder. I could walk into a room, 20 people could think of 20 different things of what I am or what I look like. Not necessarily good, or I shouldn't say that. It's not necessarily better, it's just different, okay? And sometimes make things a lot more complicated. So keep that in mind.
So what this means is that unlike New Zealand, where, for example, a bit of Māori identifies you as Māori, you are Māori. In America, where being half black means that you are black, that is your identity, you are black. Racial identity in Brazil's culture of institutionalized racism is based upon the individual's complexion. So that would be facial features, lips, hair, skin tone, eye color, all play a part, and it is essentially society that judges your literal physical appearance to be either black or white. It's not uncommon in Brazil for, say, one sister to be black and another sister to be considered white, yet they literally come from the same parents. Hence, there is a saying in Brazil that says, money whitens, meaning marrying into quote-unquote white mixed-race Brazilians elevates status. And this unique racial dynamic expresses itself in the income inequality. White Brazilians are statistically more likely to gain an internship, regular employment, and management positions. In fact, both candidates in this race would be considered white in Brazil. And this is a very clear power dynamic there, that race is not decided by your genetics, it is decided by how society literally views the individual. The difference is Bolsonaro represents the white middle class and upper class. He represents their worries and their fears. He plays upon old segregationist ideas of paternalism towards black Brazilians that have existed for centuries. He appeals to fear of crime by promising police further liberties to use violent force in favelas and the interior Amazon regions. He represents an idea among the white Brazilian minority that their loss of absolute power caused the current chaos. In a sense, he plays towards that old Brazilian idea that they are chosen to run Brazil with impunity to maintain order. So what does this mean for the poorest of the country? Well, Brazil has made strides in lifting millions out of poverty under Lula. But over the years, the poor Brazilians have been expelled from their land, pushed further out of the way, and have had opportunities disappear for them in the stagnating economy. Jails are filling and crime is rising. And it seems that under Bolsonaro, both would be solved, but in the brutal ways dictators have usually solved those issues. The 28th of October will not only decide Brazil's leader, but it will decide its political direction. Brazil took the plunge to follow its former colonial ruler into the unknown of democracy. That date will decide if the largest Portuguese-speaking nation on earth decides to keep at it.
The Wire.
Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
There was a comment made recently on, I think it was Al Jazeera, I believe. I can't confirm. Either way, it was a Brazilian political commentator said that one of the key parts of this election is that after the military dictatorship, there wasn't much of a conversation around the horrors that happened there, the tortures, the killings, the abductions, the forced expulsions, the racism, all of that stuff. There was never really an open conversation. People just kind of were quiet and moved on. And it left, like you said, it's left a lot of quite extreme feelings unmanaged sitting under the surface. Like, America's had conversations about race, Portugal and Spain have had conversations about their experience about fascism. Brazil's never had that conversation, and he said it seems to be that this is the moment where that conversation has reared its ugly head and people have said, okay, we need to talk about this. The 28th of October, we will see if Brazil stays at the experiments of democracy that they're trying out, or if they slide back into their old habits of authoritarianism.
Right.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.